You are listening to a podcast from WSUM. Catch UCM Exceptional live on Tuesdays at 4 p.m. on WSUM 91.7 FM Madison. Hello, Madison, and welcome to UCM Exceptional, an interview show that you are currently listening to on WSUM 91.7 FM Madison. Each week on this show, we will have a guest on to get to know them and their story. I am your host, Oliver Gearhars. This is my co-host,
Jeb Blossom.
And today, our guest is
Caitlin Luby.
All right, Caitlin. First, I just wanted to say thank you for coming all the way down from Milwaukee, or left from Milwaukee, to be here this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So you describe yourself as a writer. What do you write?
Yeah. So right now I'm the Great Lakes reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, but I've had a really interesting career. So I would pretty much call myself a science writer or a science communicator.
How do you differentiate between science communication and other kinds of communication?
Yeah, so I started out my career as a scientist and kind of just slowly started transitioning in who I decided I wanted to talk to. So at first, I was primarily just writing and talking for like an academic audience, but I've slowly started transitioning into, you know, talking to the public, whether or not that's doing like public speaking events or writing and whatnot, and now primarily just writing for the public.
So how long were you, so it was sort of like a scientist portion and then sort of more into science communication and then even further off into that communication side is sort of a slow shift, I guess?
Yeah, so I pretty much went, already had three different careers in my life. So a scientist, science communicator, and now science journalist.
So how long were you just pure scientist?
I was a scientist, I would say, probably for about 13 years. I started doing research as an undergrad at the University of Connecticut, and then I went on to do a little bit of research afterwards. Then I did a master's at Kane University in New Jersey, and that's where I'm from. And then I did a PhD at the University of California, Irvine. And then after that, I had a couple of jobs as a postdoc.
So as a scientist, what's your sort of area of expertise?
I would say broadly, it's climate change and soils. So I was looking at how soil microbes were responding to climate change. And soil microbes are super important because they break down plant material. And in doing so, they release carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. So that's actually a significant source of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. So I was looking at kind of how microbes were responding and how this was affecting greenhouse gas emissions.
So how were the soil microbes responding to climate change?
I worked in these really cool ecosystems called cloud forests, and they were down in the tropics. So it's a pretty specific kind of ecosystem. But when I was working down there, I found that, you know, as these cloud forests got warmer and drier, it was kind of increasing the speed at which they were breaking down plant material and then increasing carbon dioxide emissions into the atmosphere.
So what is a cloud forest?
Cloud forest? So I think they only cover like 2% of the land surface area around the world, but they are basically high elevation forests. So they occur largely on mountains, and they're pretty much like they sound, just covered in the clouds.
2% is a pretty significant piece of land. I mean, that's got to be, I don't know, a lot. I don't know how many square miles of land you've got on the earth, I guess.
Yeah, they're really cool, though. The way I used to describe them to people is like they almost have like this Dr. Seuss element to them. Like they're a little eerie and mysterious. And then when you get towards the top of the mountains, too, the plant life is a lot shorter. So everything just kind of has a little bit of a Seussical effect to it.
So why does the plant life get shorter up on the top?
You know, just because the conditions are a lot harsher and there's a lot less nutrients up there because, you know, a lot of people, when they think of tropical environments, they think about those documentary shows where they speed up kind of how much things are going on and like leaf litter is breaking down. But when you're up at the top of the mountain, things just happen a lot slower because it's actually a lot cooler. Like when I was working up there, I'd be wearing like a sweatshirt and sometimes like a beanie. So it's like not your typical tropical forest that you think of. So in general, the conditions are a lot harsher, it's a lot windier, and it's a lot cooler than you would think of in a normal tropical forest.
So what country were you in doing all this research?
Primarily Costa Rica, but I also did some work in the Dominican Republic as well.
What mountains are those then?
So in the Dominican Republic, that was the Cordillera Central. That place is really cool. It's a really high up mountain, and there's a lot of people that go up there to hike. And then in Costa Rica, I was near Monteverde, which is a big tourist town too that a lot of folks may know about. But that was the Cordillera Tilarán.
So what was like the apex of the work, the research that you did?
Yeah, so a large part of it is I was one of the first people that were actually looking at soil microbes in cloud forests. So a big part of that was kind of just characterizing what kinds of microbes were there. And specifically, I looked at fungi. So that was a big part of it, was just kind of creating this baseline information to go off of. And then also just kind of like starting some of that research and seeing how soil microbes were responding to climate change. So overall, I guess like the big piece of information I got out of it is that cloud forests are undergoing a lot of change, and these changes aren't just happening above ground, but they're also happening below ground too. And it's been said before that cloud forests are kind of considered an endangered ecosystem, and they might not be here like towards the end of my lifetime. So a big part of that was kind of just like, you know, seeing what changes are going to happen and where they're going to be happening.
So that's so interesting. there's a lot of things I want to ask. So how deep does into the soil does climate change affect?
I probably don't have a good answer to that. I would say changes probably occur pretty deep. But for my research, most of the soil microbe activity happens in like the first like 10 centimeters or maybe even more. So like I wasn't going super deep down there. I'm sure there are changes that are happening in like areas that are lower, but I was kind of just focusing on that top layer because that's where all the plant material was that had fallen from the trees.
So you said that in addition to your research sort of having its own thing, it also sort of collected a baseline of data, right?
Yeah.
So have you seen any research based off of that data you collected aside from your own?
A little bit. My work has been cited quite a bit. And yeah, just looking at how a lot of people also use cloud forests, which is something that I was doing kind of as like a proxy for climate change. So because they would happen along the mountain range, kind of like the lower levels of the mountain are kind of indicative of what future climate change may look like because they're warmer and drier. So some things that folks do is they will transplant soil from like higher up areas that are cooler and wetter and move them down to the areas that are lower, that are warmer and drier to kind of like see how things are changing with climate change. So it's kind of like by moving soil around along the mountain, you can kind of see what the future is going to look like with climate change.
So when you said that the cloud forests were an endangered ecosystem, aside from where you were researching, where are some other places on Earth that they occur?
Yeah, so I know there's some, I think Mount Kilimanjaro, I think that has a cloud forest. And then they're not all on mountain range. There's mountain ranges, but there's different kind of definitions that people have. So some people would call areas of the redwoods cloud forests because like the canopy is frequently covered in the clouds. So it kind of depends on who you ask and what kind of definition they're using for cloud forests.
The canopy thing feels like cheating to me.
I actually did some canopy soil research as well. I wasn't the person that was climbing up into the trees, but what happens in cloud forests is there's so many plants that kind of live on trees and within the canopy. So over time, as plant material falls, it collects on branches and then will decompose over time. So there's actually soil up in the canopy, which is really cool and interesting. So one of the studies I did as well was kind of looking at how does the soil up in the canopy compare to what's on the ground?
How does it compare?
It's You know, in a lot of ways, it's pretty different, but there's also some similarities, too. One thing I found was that the soil that was up in the canopy actually has a greater potential to decompose plant material. So that was something that was interesting. But the study that I did there was kind of just finding some baseline data, too. So there's a lot more to be done, but it's really cool just to think about the fact that there's actually soil up in the air as well.
And then, do you know of any other types of endangered ecosystems besides the cloud forests?
I don't know for sure, but, you know, I know there's lots of different ecosystems that, you know, are having a lot of trouble, especially with land use change. And something that, like, I talk about a lot now as a reporter are wetlands and how, you know, they're such an important ecosystem, but they're not really valued by society. So we tend to just, like, fill them and build cities on them and buildings and whatnot. And with agriculture as well, a lot of times they're just filled. So, you know, wetlands are something that I have my eye on right now.
I don't know what you said land use, and this reminded me of it. And I feel like I have to say this. How do you feel about golf courses?
You know, everything has their place. I'm not going to like sit there and, you know, trash golf courses because I understand that like recreation is really important to people and also getting out there. You know, it's probably not the best use of water and land always, but, you know, everything kind of has its place. So it's not really for me to say.
I don't know why. I had to get my golf course point out there, I guess.
It's a big thing in Wisconsin, so...
Really, I didn't know that. So to sort of jump over to the science communications portion, when did you start moving more towards that? When did you start moving more towards science communication?
So the entire time I was doing my research, one of the things that I kind of did to like volunteer and outreach and do outreach was to kind of include in communities in the work that I was doing. So I would give presentations to you know, local communities around, because I didn't want to just like helicopter in, do this work and not share the information that I was getting with them. So that's kind of how it started the evolution. And then that turned into, you know, every once in a while writing a story, whether or not it was about like safety with field work or when I was doing my master's work down in Costa Rica, there was a group of women that had started a co-op that was really great and really sustainable. So I wrote a story about them and the great work that they were doing. And then over time, it kind of just shifted into the fact that I realized I was more of a writer doing scientists instead of a scientist who was trying to write. So really just going back to like my roots and what I really valued. So on the side, I just started writing different stories for magazines. And then I did a bunch of different internships while I was doing my PhD. So I did an internship where I was writing for a radio show called the Lowdown on Science through Southern California Public Radio, which was a really cool experience because you basically are tasked with finding a research study and then explaining it in 90 seconds in a way that, you know, injects a lot of humor and is really like visual. So that was a really big challenge that I appreciated. I also worked for university media and then, yeah, just, you know, started writing a bunch more and more. I did the AAAS Mass Media Fellowship, which is a really big fellowship for scientists who are interested in writing more for the public. And then I started freelancing. I also started a freelance editing business where I started editing kind of anything you could think of on the side, from like books to dissertations to even like restaurant menus and just like text people had on their websites. So anything you can think of that had words, at some point I've probably edited something with that. And then, yeah, it just kind of shifted into, I was doing a postdoc at the University of Minnesota, and then things kind of shifted with COVID and me not being able to get down to Costa Rica to do my research. And then so I just started doing more science communication there. And then I was hired on for a year to kind of teach scientists how to talk to the public. So I had a position there where I had already started to teach a graduate class in science communication. So I kept that going. And then I was also creating workshops and whatnot just to kind of help scientists out. And then at the same time, I was freelancing, writing for different magazines and online news sites. And then I got the job at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.
So one thing that you said in there was that you sort of made an allusion to returning to your roots. Was there like anything before you started to make that shift that was where writing had played a larger part in your life?
Yeah, that's a great question. I was always really into writing when I was younger. I definitely described myself as an introvert, and kind of writing was the best way that I could, you know, kind of communicate my thoughts. And then even while I was a scientist, I kind of noticed that, you know, whenever I had to go write a grant or a fellowship application, that's kind of like what I tried to apply to everything, just because I wanted to find those opportunities to write and really appreciated it. And I noticed that, like, you know, if I had a couple tasks to do that day, whether or not it was doing like lab work or, you know, creating different reagents or whatever, and then also, you know, going to write a fellowship, I would always kind of like go to writing and kind of do those tasks first and kind of looked for any opportunity where I could write. And that was a big realization that, like, you know, that's kind of what I favor.
So when you were writing, I guess, when you were younger, was it more nonfiction writing or fiction writing?
You know, I mean, it was a lot of like different school assignments and whatnot. But, you know, I would journal a bit too. And every time, like, you know, if I had like a certain thought or idea, I would kind of just like write all sorts of things. But it was a lot of journaling and then just stuff related to whatever school assignment I was doing at the time.
So as the Great Lakes, as the person who covers the Great Lakes for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, what does that mean?
You know, it's a really big task, but it basically means that I can talk about anything that has to do with the Great Lakes, which sometimes is, you know, a really big challenge because, you know, there's so many environmental issues, so many great things going on. There's stuff with fisheries, there's stuff with shipping. I largely write environment stories, but it's anything that kind of covers the Great Lakes Basin. So I've written stories like solely about Lake Erie, a bunch about Lake Superior, and then obviously a lot about Lake Michigan, too, because that's right here in our backyards.
So that seems like there's a pretty huge range of different topics. So could you give me like an example from, I guess, two extremes to show the full range of that?
Yeah, I've written about a lot. So, you know, I wrote one story about offshore wind potentially coming to the Great Lakes. I've also written about traditional ecological knowledge and tribes and the great things that they're doing. I've also talked about water use issues. I wrote a story once on the Lake Superior Twitter account that went viral. So all sorts of things.
Do many newspapers have Great Lakes reporters?
So there's lots of people out there that cover the Great Lakes, usually through an environment beat. As far as I know, I think the Journal Sentinel is one of the few that have, you know, a specific person that is covering, you know, the Great Lakes entirely. There's lots of great outlets that are out there covering them. But I think that's just like part of a larger environmental beat.
I had a real question and then I thought of this. So which lake is the greatest?
You know, that's kind of controversial. You know, I've definitely found that people really love Lake Superior. And I think that's kind of because it's the most wild. It's the most undeveloped. It's the one that, you know, some people would say is the most pristine. I'm not partial to any specific lake, but from what I hear, I think Lake Superior is people's favorite.
So as a writer, is there anything among the things that you've written that is something that you're really very proud of?
Yeah, I write, like I said, a lot about traditional ecological knowledge. So the knowledge that tribes have held for thousands of years and, you know, kind of the way that they've been doing land stewardship and, you know, living with the land instead of working against it. And I'm really proud of that work. It's been really eye-opening. Through that, you know, I've also covered a lot about Enbridge's Line 5 oil pipeline and things like that. But I would say the work that I've done with traditional ecological knowledge and Indigenous communities, those are probably my favorite and the ones that have been the most impactful for me.
So how long have you been doing that kind of work with Indigenous communities?
I started doing that work before I came to the journal Sentinel. So I was writing, it's always been a thing for me that I try to, you know, just get diverse sources into my stories and, you know, diverse knowledges into there. So that's kind of been a common thread throughout a lot of my freelance writing. Before I came to the Journal Sentinel, I was also doing a fellowship and writing pretty consistently for an outlet called Manga Bay. So they're an international environmental news site. And one of the beats that I was covering specifically was conservation technology. And I got to talk to a lot of Indigenous people from all over the world, which was really amazing and eye-opening, from, you know, folks in New Zealand to, you know, some places in Kenya as well, and other folks down in South America.
So you were talking about, when we talked about Lake Superior, that sort of reminded me, I wanted to ask about camping, and specifically the Boundary Waters, because I've been up there, and they're really cool, and you've been up there as well.
Yeah, I've been up there now, gosh, like 5 or 6 times. The first time I ever went to the Boundary Waters was actually when I was living in Southern California. I was doing some freelance work for a magazine called Canoe and Kayak Magazine. They're now lumped under Men's Journal. But the first time I had been to the Boundary Waters was kind of one of my first times really exploring the Midwest too, and certainly my first time to Minnesota. So I was working on a story up there and went out with a group of folks. I think there was like 10 of us. We were exploring. And since then, I've kind of gone to the Boundary Waters like 5 or 6 times. A lot of the times I tack on a story to it, or, you know, we'll help do like reviews for kayaks or paddle boards and whatnot, and kind of just like participate in that. So I've really loved exploring it. It's been really great. And last fall too, since part of the Boundary Waters actually falls within the Great Lakes watershed, I was going out there just to do like my yearly vacation to the Boundary Waters, and ended up tacking on a story to that as well too, which was really eye-opening and fun to do.
So how long has it been like a yearly vacation type tradition?
I would say, so there was that one time I went in Southern California, and then that was kind of an outlier. And then when I moved to Minnesota, it was the end of 2019. So after that point, it's pretty much been a yearly thing for me.
When did you first discover sort of the interest in camping that keeps you coming back to the Boundary Waters?
So it's really interesting because, you know, a lot of folks that are either doing environmental science or environmental reporting, they grew up like around this culture of like camping and being outdoors and stuff. I really was not outdoorsy until I got into my 20s. And my first time I ever went camping was actually in this really remote location in Costa Rica, which was really wild because the conditions were really challenging and kind of hard. But ever since that, I've kind of been hooked on being outdoors and being with nature and whatnot.
I mean, you said that you've gone camping for stories, for research. Who do you typically go camping with now?
Well, my very millennial answer is that my favorite camping buddy is my dog, Odessa. So I love camping with her. I've gone with friends and groups and whatnot, and, you know, also significant others in the past. So a whole mix of folks.
So can you tell us about your dog more?
Yes. So I actually have 2 dogs, but one of them hates the outdoors, so she doesn't get to participate in this stuff. But my dog, Odessa, she's great. She has been to, I think, 25 different states in the country. She's kind of been like my travel buddy all around. But yeah, she's been camping all over. She's super great. She's great on a paddleboard. She'll just take a nap. She's good in a canoe, too. And she loves to explore.
What's your other dog's name?
Her name is Olivia. Yeah.
So you've described yourself as an outdoor enthusiast. What does that mean to you?
You know, I just really love being out in nature and experiencing that. Like, it's really great for my mental health. It's really great for my reporting. Kind of every aspect of it, I think, just really enriches my life. So I love getting out there and being in nature. I love doing adventurous kinds of things, you know, kind of having some type B fun is always great. Yeah, just being out there and, you know, getting away from cell phones and the internet and everything.
How long do you usually go on trips for?
It really depends. Like, sometimes it will just be like a one night thing. And then I think that first camping trip I did out in Costa Rica, we went to multiple locations, but that was kind of 2 weeks long. That's been my longest, which is a long time.
That's a very intense for first time camping.
Yeah, that's a lot of time to be out there.
Yeah, I went hard on that first camping trip. But, you know, camping in other places now, you know, feels a lot easier.
So it was 2 weeks. Was it up in the mountains?
It was all over. So there were places in the mountains. And then also we were down in the lowland forests, kind of by like on the beach and then up north as well, too. So kind of all different sorts of ecosystems.
So how are you getting from place to place on that trip?
That was when I was studying abroad. So we were actually just like being bussed around to those different locations. And then one of the places I went camping, we actually had to take a boat or you had to hike in. Like, there was no other way to get to it, which was pretty rad.
Yeah, I'd say the only really remote place I've camped has been the Boundary Waters. So it's sort of like, when you were up there, did you ever, how far did you go into the Boundary Waters in your times up there?
There were a couple times I went pretty far. And this last time I went, it was on a pretty commonly traveled route. I think the longest I went into the Boundary Waters was 6 nights, maybe. And that was a big loop. And we went really far in there. And then I think we did the second longest portage in the Boundary Waters, which was wild too. So that trip, we were definitely out there. And then there's been little day trips too, where we just get like a little bit into the wilderness and then camp out and then come back out.
So a portage is when you've got to take your canoe up out of the water and walk it on land over your shoulders. And it's measured in the amount of like oars, which they're called rods when they're used as measurement, yeah. Right? How many rods was your portage?
Oh, gosh. I don't remember the number of rods, but when I calculated it, that one portage I was talking about was 1.25 miles long. And the with portaging, too, is like, yeah, since you're carrying your canoe and your bags and everything, like, you don't just do it once. Like, I probably went back and forth on that portage 3 times. So, yeah, they're always a little bit harder than they seem.
I remember when I was up there with my scout troop, our goal was to go 50 miles. That was like you're going to be big and strong. You're going to go 50 miles up in the Boundary Waters. And part of that was the 180 rod portage, like right in the morning. And oh my, that one really killed us.
Yeah. You know what? It's not the long ones that bother me. It's the ones that are like maybe 10 feet or so, and you still have to take all your stuff out and move it to the other side. Those for me are just the most annoying.
There's this one spot where it was 4 of those right back to you, like go, and then you just put your canoe down in a pond. You go across the pond, you get out, you portage it another like 20 feet.
Yeah, those are really frustrating. And sometimes those are the ones I just like let my dog swim across and fend for herself.
So to jump pretty far back to working as a journalist and I guess also as an expert on the subject. Can you tell us a little bit about what it's like dealing with people who have climate change denial?
Yeah, so I'll say that, you know, over the course of when I started as a scientist doing climate change and trying to talk to folks versus now, like there has been a big improvement. So I'm just going to start out with like that positive note there that, like, you know, there's not a whole lot of climate denial out there compared to what there used to be. But, you know, you just kind of do your best. And, you know, stories really, you need to be aware of your audience. But also it's really important just to connect with what people care about, too. So finding local angles, which, of course, as a local reporter is something that I do all the time. But, you know, just like tell things not in not in just like a list of facts, but in a story, and get people to care and be like invested in the characters that you're talking about, whether or not it's people being affected by climate change or like, say, a wetland. Just like try and do your best to get people to care about those things and be invested and like show why it matters to them, whether or not it's like just for the sake of like nature being there to support, or if it's just like health benefits, you know, or also just helping people's pocketbooks as well. Just try and find those things that people care about and tell climate change stories from that angle. And just also realize too that, you know, you're not going to reach everyone, and that's fine. Your goal is not to like change everybody's mind. It's just to, you know, start conversations and kind of open those doors.
So that was sort of a kind of one of that's very similar to the advice you gave at the Daily Cardinal event. I forget what they call them. Is it alumni training? Alumni training is definitely what it is. So how did you find yourself drafted into the alumni training?
So one of my coworkers, Madeline Heim, she covers the Mississippi River Basin. So we kind of have the state split where I cover the Great Lakes. She covers the Mississippi River. She used to go here, and she definitely wrote for the Daily Cardinal. Maybe she was one of the editors too. I'm not sure. But she's an alumni there. So she kind of asked myself and another environment reporter just to talk to folks about what it's like to do environmental reporting, how to advocate for yourself in newsrooms, and like kind of really effective ways to tell environment stories.
That was a group of the three of you all from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel then?
Yes.
And so I guess kind of building on that, do you have any other advice you'd like to give to the college population while you're here on the radio?
I would just say that, you know, sometimes it can be really frustrating to stay engaged about climate change and environmental topics, but it's really important to stay engaged and, you know, kind of build as much knowledge as you can about these topics and kind of advocate for whatever it is you want to see. And, you know, no matter how jaded you get or frustrated, just kind of push through to kind of see the changes that you want to have.
So one thing in my notes that I'm looking at right now, I'm not sure what the question is, but it just says Report for America Corps. What is that about you that I wrote that down? I assume so.
Yeah, so I am employed by the Journal Sentinel through Report for America. So it's kind of like this program similar to Teach for America. So what Report for America does is they help newsrooms get more local reporting capacity. So Report for America pays part of my salary, and then the Journal Sentinel pays the other half. But it's kind of a good inroad to get more local reporters into local newsrooms.
So has that always been sort of a part of you working at the Sentinel?
Yeah, so far, everything that I've done there has been also through Report for America.
So in your time at the Journal Sentinel, do you have any good stories that you can recall just about being a journalist?
Yeah, I would say one of the things I appreciate most about being a journalist and covering the Great Lakes there is I get to see so many different cool things and get out of the newsroom. So 2 weeks ago, I went up to Ashland to view a documentary about the Line 5 pipeline and the Bad River Band. I got to do a screening with the Bad River Band, which was really amazing and a great experience. And then I also went over an hour east in the Upper Peninsula to go visit a site where they're proposing to put a mine near the Porcupine Mountain Wilderness State Park. So I had been working on a story there as well. So I went up to take some photos and sit down with my sources and get some more information. And, you know, it's just great to be able to be out in nature and see things and see Lake Superior and kind of experience those things with my sources as I tell those stories.
So you kind of go all over the place in your reporting.
Yeah, I mean, largely it's been around Lake Superior and Lake Michigan. I hope to get out to see some more of the other lakes this summer. But yeah, I've been all the way around Lake Superior, at least on the U.S. side, all the way up to Grand Portage last summer, and then stopped at lots of different sites along the way. So I am really grateful that I've been able to, you know, actually see the things that I'm talking about in my stories.
So how do you usually get around? Do you just drive from place to place?
Yeah, lots of driving. I've also done some great programs through this Journalism Institute, which has been great. I think they're also based here in Madison. So they do a lot of kind of field trips based around the Great Lakes. So tagged along with them and, you know, met with sources on different topics and just have the opportunity to learn about all the things going on around here.
So we're kind of nearing the end of our show now. So is there anything else you sort of want to talk about or anything that you think would be a good way to wrap this up?
I think something that's really important for folks to hear and something that I can contribute and have a lot of experience is that, you know, it's okay to take different career paths. And, you know, having a 30-year long career doesn't need to be for everyone. So kind of just chase your passions. And if that means you're going to pivot and take another turn in life, I definitely, you know, encourage people to do so, even though in some ways it may feel like starting over, but you're always bringing all that background experience that you have into your new opportunities. And it's always great to have a unique background, whether you're entering a new job or a new career or whatever new experience you're attempting to tackle.
Well, that's very, I think that's kind of the core of what we were getting at this whole time, I suppose. So also before we end, I'd like to say, Caitlin, you definitely seem exceptional.
Thank you.
All right. So as a reminder, you can find all the old installments of the show at WSUM.org under the podcast tab. And oh, as another reminder, the opinions expressed on this show do not reflect the views of WSUM, the University of Wisconsin-Madison, or its Board of Regents. Goodbye for now, Madison. We will be back at the same time next Tuesday.